Thank you, and I am really, really happy to be here and happy to look out and see so many familiar faces in this audience. I've lived here at several different times. We have here some good friends that I went to St. Catharines with, and then I was back again working on the Richmond News Leader for a while, and then I was back again teaching at VCU and living in the Fan District. It's always a real pleasure to be here. I'm going to read to you tonight from my new novel, which is named On Agate Hill. This is my first foray into real historical fiction. You know, I come from the mountains of Southwest Virginia, from Buchanan County, where we really did not pay very much attention to the Civil War. Nobody gave a damn about the Civil War. As far as I could tell, I mean, I never heard a word about it. I don't think we did it. We like to fight. But I think some people who did join that conflict fought for the South. Others fought for the North. Most people, I don't think, did very much about it. I mean, we didn't have anything to lose, might be like the rest of the country. Certainly no flatland aristocracy, no aristocracy or flatland, either one. The only columns in the county were on the Presbyterian Church. So it was a very different South. I had a hard time trying to explain this to my new mother-in-law because I took her up to Grundy, you know, and she kept saying things like, where are the mansions? Where are the cotton fields? Where is this and where is that? But the Mountain South, of course, is a completely different South, and different still from the Piedmont, North Carolina, which is where my husband and I live now, in a little town named Hillsboro, which is just north of Chapel Hill. I mention this because this is entirely why I became addicted finally to the Civil War. It may be an illness that strikes all Southern writers at a particular time. I don't know. But in our case, Hal and I moved into a very old house. Very, very old house. Our yard adjoins the Civil War Cemetery with, you know, CSA on all those little mossy stones and these distressingly short dates. So I took to walking in the cemetery, and it began to make an impression. And then a very old man in town came and knocked on our door before we were even completely unpacked. And I opened the door, and he said, "Honey, let me in." So I let him in. He said, "I've come to tell you a story about your house." Well, this is what every novelist wants to hear. So, of course, I said, "Come in, sit down," and he told me his story, which is one of obsessive love, which I cannot resist telling just briefly. Apparently, there were two lawyers in Hillsboro, North Carolina, who fell in love with the same beautiful girl from Tarboro, and her name was Annie Gray, and they courted her. But she chose, of course, the young, good-looking one named Sam Nash, who had been a hero in the Wawa. And so she chose him. She did not choose the older, dark, saturnine Alan Ruffin, who was very old, at least in his 40s, when he was trying to court her. So she married Sam Nash and moved into his family home called Pilgrim's Rest on Queen Street in Hillsboro. Well, Alan Ruffin proceeded to buy up all the land surrounding this house and convert a smaller house right across from Pilgrim's Rest into his own home, which is our house. So he was just as close as possible to his beloved as she began her new married life. Soon enough, she had her own baby, a little girl, whom she named Annie Gray. And at that point, according to town legend, old Alan Ruffin walked across the street, knocked on the door, and when Annie Gray opened the door with her baby, Annie Gray, he said, "If I could not have you, my darling, then I shall have your daughter." Is this not so creepy? Well, Then, this gives me chills. Then, when the baby, Annie Gray, was 16, Alan Ruffin again walked across the street and married her. Married her and brought her back, and she had a baby in my TV room. So this is really interesting to me. And when you read this book, you will see how this kind of a story finds its way. That is, a man who was so much in love with a woman that he becomes obsessed with her daughter as well. So this kind of finds its way. Then I go down to the corner of the block where our house, our old house is, and there is the Orange County Historical Museum. The wonderful young scholar who is also a reenactor, and his name was Dr. Ernest Dollar. And not only was he a reenactor, but so was his wife and so was his baby. They just got me really interested, and he kept spoon-feeding me things to read. And one thing he gave me was the diary of a young girl who had been in a boarding school during the 1870s in North Carolina. And I love that because, I guess because I've always loved Jane Eyre. It's one of my favorite books. In fact, I think one of the reasons I ever started writing in the beginning was simply because I could not stand for my favorite books to end. And I would write more and more on to the end of them. Like more and more on to Heidi, more and more on to Johnny Tremaine. More and more on to the Secret Garden, chapters and chapters. I think in a way that's what I've done here. It's just written more and more on to Jane Eyre. You might call this Jane Eyre with sex. But anyway, okay. So I get interested in this boarding school business. And then up on the other corner is the Burwell School, which was a girls' boarding school. So I go up there and the nice young historian says, "What would you like to see? The diary kept by Anna Burwell." Well, naturally, I said, "Yes, I would love to see this." Well, she was a real case. She stood 6 feet tall. When the pork was delivered, like when the hogs were delivered, she would go out and chop them up with an axe herself for the kitchen. And then she would go in and clean up and teach Greek and Latin all day long. She knew Paradise Lost by heart. She had 12 children, and she was always writing in her journal, though, that her husband, who had a little stone house outside the main house where he would sit and write his sermons, and she would always say, "He is so cold. God, give me the grace to bear this aright." But, I mean, how cold could he be with these 12 children? I don't know. Anyway, I just got fascinated. So a lot of things were coming together, and I just began to read and read and read, and we, of course, have the Southern Historical Collection at the Wilson Library at the University of North Carolina, and there's no end of wonderful letters and diaries and things to read, and people express themselves so beautifully. I mean, when I contrast this with the emails that I send to people or get. I mean, it's a whole different, we're losing a lot. I mean, we're really losing something. But anyway, I just got addicted to this period. The aspect of it that interested me the most was something I had never understood, I guess, in college, in history courses, which is that the amazing displacement caused in the South by the Civil War, which runs counter to our somewhat hackneyed notion, I think, of the South as a place where nobody ever went anywhere and everybody just sat on their front porch for six generations or whatever. That's not true. During the Civil War, one of the major changes was this incredible displacement. Not only the great armies, everyone leaving home to serve in these great armies, which were crisscrossing the land, especially Virginia, but also people, for instance, from the Deep South, from Georgia, fleeing Sherman, coming up to Piedmont, North Carolina, other people leaving the little farms that they couldn't run any longer with the men gone, African Americans fleeing, going north, just leaving, everybody leaving where they were from. It was this huge displacement, refugee movement. This really struck me, and I was particularly interested in a number of these refugee lives. And then while I was writing the book, Katrina happened, And so, you know, you see all these refugees and that kind of a plight, that kind of displacement becomes even more real. So anyway, let me just read you a little bit from On Agate Hill, where my main character is Molly Petrie, and her mother has fled a plantation in South Carolina and ended up in Piedmont, North Carolina, in a tumble-down plantation house outside of Hillsboro, North Carolina, and the name of it is Agate Hill. And the reason I named that, frankly, is because one of my best friends wrote a ballad named Agate Hill, and I wrote the liner notes to her CD. And somehow, it's a song about loss, the loss of her mother. But somehow, it just kind of was playing in my mind the whole time that I was writing this. So anyway, I named my plantation Agate Hill. And now we're making a CD, I'm so excited to say, which is Alice is singing and all I get to do is talk. But it's going to be music from Agate Hill. But anyway, okay, it starts as a diary kept by Molly Petrie, and I'll just read you a little bit of this. Dear Diary, this book belongs to me, Molly Petrie, age 13 today, May 20th, in the year of our Lord, 1872, Agate Hill, North Carolina. I'm an orphan girl. This is my own book of my own self, given to me by the preacher's wife, Nora Gwynn, who said, "This little diary is for you, my dear unfortunate child, to be your friend and confidant, to share all your thoughts and deepest secrets, for I know how much you need a friend, and also how much you love to read and write. I do believe you have a natural gift for it. Now it is my special hope that you will set down upon these pages your own memories of your lovely mother and your brave father and of all your three brothers as well and of all that has befallen you. For I believe this endeavor might help you, Molly Petrie. So I urge you to take pen in hand, commencing your diary with these words, 'Thy will be done, O Lord, on earth as it is in heaven. Amen.'" Well, I have not done this, and I will not do it either. No matter how much I love pretty Nora Gwynn, who looks like a lady on a fancy plate and has taught me such few lessons as I have had since Aunt Fanny died. No, for I mean to write in secrecy and stealth the truth as I see it. I know I'm a spitfire and a burden. I do not care. My family's a dead family, and this is not my home, for I am a refugee girl. I'm like the ruby-throated hummingbird that comes again and again to Fanny's red rosebush but lights down never for good and all, always flying on. And it's true that often I feel so lonesome for all of them that are gone. I live in a house of ghosts. I was born before the surrender and dragged from pillar to post, as Mama always said, until we fetched up here in North Carolina after Columbia fell. Our sweet Willie was born there into a world of war. He was real little, all waxy and bloody, and old Bess put him into a dresser drawer while the fires burned red outside the windows. Mama used to tell it in that awful whisper which went on and on through the long, hot nights when she could not sleep. And it was my job to wet the cool cloths required for her forehead, which I did faithfully. I loved my mama, but I was glad when she finally died. I know this is a sin. I have not told it before, but I'm writing it down anyway, as Nora Gwynn said, and I will write it all down, every true thing, in black and white upon the page. For evil or good, it is my own true life, and I will have it. I will. I am the legal ward of my Uncle Junius Jefferson Hall, who is not really my uncle at all, but my mother's first cousin, a wise and mournful man who's done the best he could for us all, I reckon. We arrived here during the last days of the war to a house running over already, thus giving Uncle Junius more than 30 people on this place to feed then, Negro and white alike. Uncle Junius used to be a kind, strong man, but he's sick and seems so sad and lost in thought now, since Fanny died. This is his wife, my dear Aunt Fanny, who is recently deceased. It's been 7 months now. and the baby inside her, born dead and backward. I will never have a baby myself. The things that people really want are the most like to kill them, it seems to me, such as war and babies. And then I'll read you a little bit from the very end of that section. Molly has found a little cubbyhole up under the eaves of this tumble-down house. Is a little space which she has found behind some hanging dresses in an attic closet. She's found a space, and she goes back in there, and she has taken a little chair. She's got an ammunition box as her table, and it's here that she goes to write in her diary and peep out and record everything that she can see, which is going on in the rest of the plantation. This is her cubbyhole and her hideaway. She calls herself a ghost girl because I think it's instructive that nobody misses her when she's up there all this long length of time, because the plantation at this point, since her Aunt Fanny died and her Uncle Junius is sick, the plantation is just kind of going to hell in a handbasket, as my mother used to say. There is an evil housekeeper named Selina who is worming her way into Uncle Junius's affections. And I think I've really, as I said, written a 19th century novel here. So we have to have an evil housekeeper. Okay, this is the very end of this section. Nora Gwynn and her husband are trying to find Molly to tell her goodbye, but she's up in her cubbyhole, not coming down. And she looks out at the end of this very first section. I look out my cubbyhole window. There stands Uncle Junius at the gate to the overseer's house. There stands Uncle Junius bareheaded in the sun with his jacket folded over his arm. It is like he is under a spell. He stands there until Selina herself comes busting out of the open door with her black hair just washed and hanging down almost to her waist in waves like some animal's shiny coat. She is barefoot, wearing a loose white blouse and a red skirt. She has got a big smile on her big red mouth, and her black eyes flash in the sun like the fool's gold I keep in my pocket. Uncle Junius says something, and Selina says something, and throws back her head and laughs. Her hair falls all down her back. Then she opens the gate and goes to Uncle Junius and wraps her arms around him like a vine, like poison ivy is what I think. All I can see of Uncle Junius is the back of his head, but Selina lifts her head all of a sudden and stares straight up at this chimney. I know she cannot really see me, but it's like she's staring right at me. And then she smiles. She knows she can do anything or have anything she wants. They stand like this in the hot sun a while, and then keeping one arm around his waist, Selina walks Uncle Junius into the overseer's house through the open door. They disappear from view. Now the yard is quiet once more, with no one present except for Virgil's old dog that dreams a running dream in the sun, and Daddy Rex, who sits outside his cabin but never saw a thing since he is blind. And as for me, my heart is beating very hard in my chest, and I feel like I cannot breathe. I know for sure that everything will be very different from now on. So this is obviously a rapidly deteriorating situation from which Molly will at length be rescued by the mysterious stranger, another somebody we have to have in the Victorian novels, the mysterious stranger, who will arrive in the nick of, not quite in the nick of time, take her and put her into a boarding school to keep her safe. This is Simon Black, who actually, you will not be surprised to hear, used to be in love with Molly's mother. Although this is a whole story that we learn as we go on. So I'm going to read you one tiny little section because I had so much fun. The next section is from the headmistress's journal, okay? And I named her Mariah Rutherford Snow, and her husband, who is so cold, is named Dr. Cincinnatus Snow. And her journal is named For No One's Eyes, July 20th. And she takes an immediate hatred, immediate dislike and jealousy of Molly. For No One's Eyes, July 20th, 1873. My attempt to get rid of this child having ended in terrible argument, I excused myself from the breakfast table and went out to water the plants on the porch. Not 5 minutes had passed before I sensed the silent presence of Dr. Snow behind me. I continued my work, every nerve on edge. "What is it?" I finally whirled about to ask, whereupon he told me frankly that Simon Black is paying so much money to Gatewood Academy that we shall be able to meet our note after all, plus send our own boys off to their respective boarding schools as planned and have adequate funds left over for repairs to this academy. "So you see, we have no choice," he said, following me along the row of pots. "Simon Black has made a substantial investment in this academy." "But, Dr. Snow, that is bribery," I said, though I dared not turn to see his face. "On the contrary, Mariah, it is business. Do I make myself clear?" He gripped my elbow so tightly that I cried out, dropping my bucket, which rolled off the porch, spilling water. "Furthermore, I consider it our Christian duty to save this girl. Nothing happens without God's knowledge. Remember this, Mariah. Molly Petrie has been sent to us for a reason. The Lord works in mysterious ways, and it is not up to us to question him. I know you will do your best with her." "Dr. Snow," I said, "you are hurting my arm." But he did not release it, pulling me toward him and into the house, where, to my surprise, he exercised his conjugal rights upon the hall bench in broad daylight. "He seems to be quite worked up in general by all that has transpired. I occupied myself by reciting the beginning of Paradise Lost, all the while, finishing up about the same time he did. Today, I took my cold bath a bit earlier than usual." This situation will obviously become somewhat dangerous for Molly as well. And so a lovely young teacher there in the school takes her, and they flee to the mountains where they accept a teaching post in a one-room school. People are always fleeing in this book. She gets up there, and the son of the owner of the blanket factory takes a fancy tour, and it finally looks as if things are going to work out for Molly. She's going to be taken care of. She will have something in this world. Until, unfortunately, she goes to a dance, a house party, you know, where people take all the furniture out of the house and a band comes over and all this. This would be in the 1870s. And she meets a banjo player named Jackie Jarvis. So I just read you one little scene. Okay, this is where she meets him. This is her. This is Molly writing again later, just right after this. She's writing a letter at this point. "The sun was already down by that time, and they were building a great big fire out front, when all of a sudden there was a commotion out in the yard, and in walked a man in a wide hat with a banjo slung across his shoulder. 'Hey, Jack, Yellow Jack, hey, Jack, Jackie-o.' Everybody called out and fell back to make way as he crossed the dance floor. 'Where the hell have you been?' the old man grumbled. But the man just grinned as he flung his buckskin coat down on the floor and started right in picking his banjo, jumping all around. He appeared to have no bones at all in his body. He was tall and skinny, with yellow-red hair that fell forward into his eyes, and a big nose and a wide, crooked, reckless grin. The kind of a face that you couldn't quit looking at. He played that old knockdown two-finger way and had a loud, clear singing voice. He was the kind of man that made everybody feel better just because he had walked into the room. The dancing picked up with several people whooping out now. The music went faster and faster. Martha had long since stopped dancing and stood fanning herself, but I wouldn't have quit for anything. I don't know what got into me, but it has still got into me." And then she tells this one little conversation, and then I'll quit, and any questions will be fine. So they're all dancing, and Molly starts dancing too, even though she doesn't really quite know how to square dance and what they're doing. She says, "I didn't know what I was doing, but it was all right, and it was the most fun since I have had since Henderson," that's her fiancé, "went back to Salisbury." Finally, they quit playing, and I was dying for air. I pushed my way outside where the cold night was filled with the smell of smoke and coffee. The big fire blazed. Here, honey. Somebody handed me a tin cup with coffee and whiskey in it. Now they had put a table of food out there, too, but I couldn't eat for the stitch in my side from dancing. I stood back in the trees away from the fire and sipped at the cup. My hair was falling all down my back and my blouse was wet clear through from dancing. My name is Jackie Jarvis, he said into my ear, and I've been looking for you all my life. I whirled around. That's a lie, I cried. You never even heard of me before. His breath on my neck gave me the shivers. But I've been dreaming about you every night, he said. So I knowed you right off. Maybe I just dreamed you up. His face was real close to mine. He was grinning such a wide, devil-may-care grin that he made me dizzy. Oh, is that a fact, I said, stepping back from him. Well, too bad, you're too late. I held up my hand and my ring caught the firelight, winking at him. He gave a long, low whistle through his teeth. Mighty fine ring, he said. Who is the lucky feller? Nobody you know. Maybe, maybe not, he said, looking at me. He kept on looking at me. Molly, Martha called, peering across the fire. Come on, honey, we've got to go. I knew she couldn't see me back there in the dark. He touched my elbow. Listen, I'm coming to see you tomorrow. You are not, I said. You haven't been invited. You don't know where I live. You don't even know who I am. He smiled out from under the brim of his hat. I'll find out. I'll give you your own private music show. Molly, Martha was calling. I turned to go, then turned back. Don't come tomorrow, I said. Come Sunday. So Molly is obviously going to get in a lot of trouble. You know, she's maybe makes some bad decisions, but none of us have ever made any, right? Anyway, I think in a way this book is sort of a dialectic between the Molly we see at the beginning who is hidden away and says, I will never fall in love, I will never have babies, I will never give all my heart, and then the very passionate person she becomes who is really the stuff of a ballad. You know, it's a sort of a dialectic between those two opposing ways of life. So I'll close by reading a ballad. A lot of stuff is going to happen here. There's going to be a fire and a murder and a court case and all kinds of things. And this is only one version of it. Jackie Jarvis's family runs a store, and that's going to burn up. And a lot of stuff happens. I'm just going to read you this ballad. I'm just talking to my friend Greg. We always go to the Merle Watson Festival. I'm such a fan of music. And if I could sing, I would never have written any of these books, frankly. However, this is, and Alice is recording this too. This is a traditional ballad from Ashe County, North Carolina, written by me, of course. It's not really traditional. It's named Molly and the Traveling Man. Gather round, ye young lovers, and I will tell how a match struck in heaven can end up in hell. They was two lovers met at a dance one night. They fell in love by the fire's bright light. Well, it burned them up like a fire will do. Now there ain't nothing left but ashes and rue. Lord, Lord, ashes and rue. There ain't nothing left but ashes and rue. And a smoking ruin on a mountain top, and a gal who begged her traveling man to stop. Then she shot him dead and burned up the store. Said, honey, you ain't going off traveling no more. For Jack was bound to wander like a man will do. Now there ain't nothing left but ashes and rue. Lord, Lord, ashes and rue. There ain't nothing left but ashes and rue. She held up her head. She looked left and right. Her yellow hair hung down and her eyes shone bright. She come walking down the mountain so fancy and so free. And that big crowd, it parted like the sea. Lord, Lord, that big crowd, it parted like the sea. She was all dressed up in satin blue. Now there ain't nothing left but ashes and rue. And the wind blows cold on that mountain so drear, for pretty Molly is gone far away from here. And you can't buy love nor hear the banjo ring, for the general store ain't selling anything. Lord, Lord, it's true. That store ain't selling nothing but ashes and rue. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.